wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM in Portland, Oregon. This is Norm Diamond. Our engineer is Patricia Kohlberg. You will hear Patricia's dulcet voice as the program continues. She's more than an engineer today. On today's program, we inaugurate a regular feature, Another World is Possible, with its very own theme music. As part of Another World is Possible, Louisa May Alcott visits us with a delightful story about attempting to set up a utopian community. Veering more toward dystopia, Bill Resnick interviews a New York City nurse caught in the midst of capitalism's response to the coronavirus. Larry Bolden reviews a favorite of mine, Molly Gloss's year 2000 novel, Wildlife, set partly in the nearby Skamakaway sloughs where I kayak. Finally, the well-read Red contrasts Turkish writer Orhan Pamuk with David Brooks, New York Times columnist, both writing, but in very different ways, about pandemics. A number of Old Mole hosts introduced the program with a play on the program's name, talk about coming to you from the underground, bringing a bottom-up perspective. I'm actually going to critique that underground notion in a minute. But today, with the station closed, we are literally broadcasting in an underground manner. The way, for instance, radio worked in the French resistance to the plague of the German occupation in World War II. Or Radio Venceremos in El Salvador's revolutionary movement. That is, pieces recorded in dispersed locations, some of them written in one place, recorded in another, all of them then sent to one minimally staffed, vulnerable location for broadcast. Fortunately, we don't have to keep moving the studio to avoid detection. I do want to remind you, though, of KBOO's vulnerability in a financial as well as health-related sense. Because of the coronavirus, we've had to cancel the spring fundraising drive. If you're able, please go to the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and donate whatever you can. The Old Mole Variety Hour has been on the air for more than 30 years. It's time to take stock. For years, when we were able to have membership or fundraising drives, the wonderful volunteers who made the appeals would often say things like, "The Old Mole brings you information you can't get anywhere else," and I would protest. It's not so much information we offer, though we certainly do some of that, but perspective. Not so much reporting on activist efforts, but critical engagement toward what can actually work and what is, on the contrary, simply spinning our wheels. I used to introduce the program by saying something like, "This is a show for old moles like you and our studio visitors and interviewees and me, who continue to resist the powers that be. We old moles keep alive, in our actions as our thoughts, the assurance that something very much better is possible. On the Old Mole Variety Hour, we not only celebrate the myriad ways that people push for alternatives, we analyze them. Not all forms of resistance are effective, can actually change what exists. Celebration, vision, and analysis are themes for today and every week." That's still what I think the Old Mole stands for. Not everything we do lives up to this, but this is the Old Mole aspiration, as I see it. Which brings me back to the play on words connected to Karl Marx's metaphor of the Old Mole and the notion of an underground point of view. What Marx meant was something more challenging than a people's history, more revolutionary than only a report on struggles from the standpoint of the people, however rare and interesting that is in itself. What Marx had in mind was people coming to consciousness through struggle, realizing their interests in common, realizing the systemic character of what would need to be changed, understanding the vastly different alternatives that are possible, evaluating them, and learning how to move toward the desirable ones. Activism all by itself, however exhilarating, however inspiring, doesn't automatically create that consciousness. There's a need, too, for reflection in the midst of struggle. I recently received a letter questioning the Old Mole. Here's what it said. What audience are you trying to appeal to? Is your audience people who already share similar learning and worldview with you? Or are you trying to reach out to less educated, informed, and sophisticated people than you to teach them to a new way of thinking? Here's what I wrote back. The choices are not simply preaching to the choir or reaching out to the less sophisticated. The choir itself has a lot of growing to do. We are critical of the status quo and inclined to activism, but still with too little sense of how to distinguish between ways of being active, how to think strategically, how even to understand the implications of different or competing positions and programs. My response continued, I see our effort on the Old Mole in part as refining and intensifying our own capacities along with those of our listeners, who in turn aim at reaching everybody else. I think of it as similar to the work I've done in developing teachers and rank-and-file worker leaders, which is different from directly being a classroom teacher or workplace activist, both of which, incidentally, I've done also. Radio by itself, like even the best of conversations, is only part of the process. If we do it well, it can be an important aid to reflection, a necessary complement to being in the streets, the classrooms, and every other site of our activism. That was my response to that letter. That's a high goal we set. I hope you, our listeners, find our efforts useful. And now, it's time for Another World is Possible. That was the refrain from The Guillotine, performed by The Coup. It was suggested as theme music for this part of The Old Mole, called Another World is Possible, by Candy Luisa Herrera. We'll hear from Candy about her musical choice in just a bit. What do we mean when we say another world is possible? Drawing on utopian and dystopian literature and so much more, this regular feature on the Old Mole Variety Hour will explore the many dimensions of that sonorous phrase. To begin, here's part of a very funny story by Louisa May Alcott about a mid-19th century effort to set up a utopian community. The story is called Transcendental Wild Oats.
There is our new abode, announced the enthusiast, smiling with a satisfaction quite undamped by the drops dripping from his hat brim, as they turned at length into a cart path that wound along a steep hillside into a barren-looking valley. A little difficult of access, observed his practical wife as she endeavored to keep her various household goods from going overboard with every lurch of the laden ark. Like all good things, but those who earnestly desire and patiently seek will soon find us, placidly responded the philosopher from the mud, through which he was now endeavoring to pilot the much-enduring horse. Truth lies at the bottom of a well, Sister Hope, said Brother Timon, pausing to detach his small comrade from a gate, whereon she was perched for a clearer gaze into futurity. "That's the reason we so seldom get at it, I suppose," replied Mrs. Hope, making a vain clutch at the mirror, which a sudden jolt sent flying out of her hands. "We want no false reflections here," said Timon, with a grim smile, as he crunched the fragments underfoot in his onward march.
We'll return to the story in a moment, as we begin to see the gendered nature of this quest for an alternative way of living. Most of what you hear on the Old Mole Variety Hour deals in one way or another with Another World is Possible. In this regular feature, we'll simply try to do so in a direct and organized manner. In addition to literary utopias and dystopias, we'll examine questions like whether genuine democracy is really possible, and the challenges to that possibility in the fields of sociology, psychology, and liberal political philosophy. I'll give you a clue now. Early developments in each of those fields are specifically designed to show the impossibility of people collectively managing their own society. We'll evaluate their reasoning and conclusions. For another example of a question we'll address, the resistance within much of Marxism to utopian thinking, and the minority traditions within Marxism that embrace it. Or a completely different area of interest, why dystopias in particular seem to appeal to adolescents. We'll look at some of the themes that pervade utopian and dystopian literature, like the supposed choice between security and individual freedom, or the ambiguous possibilities of sexuality. And we'll come back often to the complex relationship between those supposedly opposite but really closely linked categories of utopia and dystopia. One of my own formative experiences, something I can still conjure up in memory, was riding home from high school on a public bus and trading Aldous Huxley's Ape and Essence for Rousseau's Social Contract. Trading, in other words, a dystopia, a book meant to warn us of the dangers ahead if we didn't act, for a book that opened up for me the possibilities of a society very much better than what exists. Over time, I hope to persuade you, the listeners, not only that another world is possible, which you may already to some extent believe, but that deep down, it really is possible. I come out of the movement of the extended 1960s, anti-war, civil rights, feminist, that even back then didn't seem to me as if most of my sister and brother participants thought and acted as if they believed at the core of their being that things could be fundamentally different. We are surrounded now by a culture that encourages a sense of determinism and inevitability, that the social and economic arrangements that exist are the only ones that could exist, that all history has led to where we are now and could have led nowhere else. Our work, our TV watching, internet browsing, sports spectatorship are structured in ways that make it increasingly difficult to imagine significant alternatives. Really, to make a difference, we have to change that sense of possibility. So, will the intrepid pilgrims in Louisa May Alcott's story succeed in establishing a utopia? Or is that too much to expect for mid-19th century? They settled in, and Alcott tells us, I believe, tongue in cheek, "Having cast the forms and vanities of a depraved world behind them, the elders welcomed hardship with the enthusiasm of new pioneers, and the children heartily enjoyed this foretaste of what they believed was to be sort of a perpetual picnic. Other people arrive, and the leadership lays down the rules about permitted clothing, permitted kitchenware, permitted foods, none of which take into account the interests of the woman who will actually be responsible for clothing and feeding everyone and cleaning up after them. And then we get another statement of idealistic principles.
Each member is to perform the work for which experience, strength, and taste best fit him, continued Dictator Lion. Thus, drudgery and disorder will be avoided and harmony prevail. We shall rise at dawn, begin the day by bathing, followed by music, and then a chaste repast of fruit and bread. Each one finds congenial occupation till the meridian meal, when some deep, searching conversation gives rest to the body and development to the mind. Healthful labor again engages us till the last meal, when we assemble in social communion, prolonged till sunset, when we retire to sweet repose, ready for the next day's activity. What part of the work do you incline to yourself? Asked Sister Hope, with a humorous glimmer in her keen eyes.
Note that humorous glimmer. The furniture arrives. Sister Hope settles into the kitchen. There are more rules in the interests of pure living that don't take into account the needs of women's work. As Alcott remarks, only a brave woman's taste, time, and temper were sacrificed on that domestic altar. They farmed. They make practical compromises with their idealistic principles. Inexperienced farmers, they also make mistakes. They work out education for the children, but Alcott oddly doesn't use the opportunity either to promote or spoof particular educational principles. Their motives turn out to vary a bit based on who had invested more resources. And then there was the issue of the market.
Money was abjured as the root of all evil. The produce of the land was to supply most of their wants or be exchanged for the few things they could not grow. This idea had its inconveniences, but self-denial was the fashion, and it was surprising how many things one can do without. When they desired to travel, they walked, if possible, begged the loan of a vehicle, or boldly entered car or coach, and, stating their principles to the officials, took the consequences. Usually, their dress, their earnest frankness, and gentle resolution won them a passage. But now and then they met with hard usage and had the satisfaction of suffering for their principles.
The men clearly are more interested in traveling to promote their vision. As a result, the crops fail. Sister Hope and the children are left to harvest what they can. Her husband is ready to give up everything.
He had tried, but it was a failure. The world was not ready for utopia yet, and those who attempted to found it only got laughed at for their pains. In other days, men could sell all and give to the poor, lead lives devoted to holiness and high thought, and after the persecution was over, find themselves honored as saints or martyrs. But in modern times, these things are out of fashion. To live for one's principles at all costs is a dangerous speculation. And the failure of an ideal, no matter how humane and noble, is harder for the world to forgive and forget than bank robbery or the grand swindles of corrupt politicians.
But his wife, Sister Hope, with her practical sense, finds them shelter and work back in the mainstream society. Thus, the struggle between idealism and practicality, vision and skepticism, in this case, a gendered struggle that underlies so much of the response to utopia.
Good morning, Candy.
Good morning.
It's wonderful to have you on the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Candy Luisa Herrera. Candy is an organizer for the Washington Education Association. You took on kind of a tough challenge. I already mentioned on the program that you were the music muse for our new segment, Another World is Possible. And I asked you to come up with music that would both reflect utopian and dystopian themes. What was your thinking?
Well, my thinking was primarily to maybe pick some music from the last 20 years or so.
Well, you picked out a few things, and from them, I selected By the Coup, by Boots Riley's group, The Guillotine. say something more specific about that. How does it fit our kind of motif?
Sure. Well, both Riley and then all the folks who are part of the coup, they're Marxists. They're pretty unapologetic about it. So, Boots Riley, who was recently on Democracy Now! Talking about his wonderful labor film, Sorry to Bother You. And Amy Goodman said, you're an anti-capitalist musician. And he interrupted her mid-sentence and said, no, I'm a communist. The refrain, the hook of the song, We Got the Guillotine, You Better Run, is kind of a nod to your original choice, but a little bit more explicit in its meaning.
And we chose to use the refrain, We Got the Guillotine, as our motif. So you'll hear it monthly. You'll hear it every time we come back to this segment of the program, Another World is Possible. The second choice that appealed to me and that I almost went with was by Calle 13, or just having got off the phone from my son, who's quarantined down in remote regions of Colombia, where they pronounce this Calle 13. The song was Pal Norte. How about it? What's the appeal there?
Well, that song is just a song about hope, about understanding what is sometimes necessary. And, you know, I believe when migrants and immigrants, you know, I'm an immigrant myself, when we move from Latin America to the United States, it's not anything that we, it's something done out of necessity, but while still retaining some sense of hope. And I think that song reflects dignity more than anything.
An aspiration, yeah. Yeah, looking forward to some kind of a future that is a whole lot better than what we're subject to today. That was the appeal for me of that song as well. Candy, thank you very much. Hope to hear much more from you in future broadcasts.
Thanks so much, Norm.
And here's Bill Resnick with Ted Levine, a New York City nurse.
Ted Levine, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Ted Levine is a nurse in New York City. He's living the COVID epidemic. He's a union member and a rank-and-file activist. He's also, though, been a spokesman in rallies for the nurses now. He speaks out on social media. He's also on the state contract bargaining team for the nurses' union, and he knows what they are doing and thinking and part of the decision process. We'll be discussing the COVID epidemic in New York, the hell that frontline workers are experiencing, their recognitions that they and their families are risking death because of the systematic profit over all mentality, and also the incompetence of our national elites. We'll discuss all that, as well as the potential political response over the next years by these millions of workers and their more millions of allies. So first, Ted, tell us what New York nurses and other frontline workers are going through.
Well, Bill, it's a very diverse experience because I happen to work in a facility in a private hospital with a lot of resources, fortunately. And despite that, we have felt the horrible effects of this pandemic and of the lack of preparation, the lack of leadership, and everything else. And what some of my fellow healthcare workers in the public hospitals and in the less resourced privates have experienced is many degrees worse than even what I will describe from my own experience. There's a lot to say about this. This virus is truly, truly terrible, and it's hard for people who are not in the hospitals to wrap their mind around how bad this is. We see many patients who are, aside from the respiratory problems, the shortness of breath, they're on every kind of respiratory support. We have a lot of patients who are having organ failure. They're having kidney failure. It's affecting their thinking. We have a lot of patients who are going through delirium. They're confused. Things are being done to them and they don't understand. They can't cooperate. And sometimes we have to restrain their arms in order to do our procedures. And so for the patients, it's really hellish. And of course, there are the very sick ones who are in the ICUs and that are intubated, and many, many, many patients who are dying. Not just people who are elderly, but many young people as well. Although there's much higher incidence of severe cases with people with pre-existing conditions like diabetes and hypertension, heart disease. There are many people who have few to none of these pre-existing conditions as well, getting very sick with this. And then you're hearing reports of strokes after even mild cases, children coming in with syndrome that's like Kawasaki's disease, very serious illness. So nobody's immune to this. And working on the front lines, it can be very traumatic to constantly witness the daily suffering of so many of these patients. To add to that, we have been working without the tools that we need to do this safely. In the early days of this pandemic, we were told initially the guidance from the CDC was that we needed to observe what are called airborne precautions for patients with COVID. And that's a very strict set of protective measures. On airborne precautions, patients should be in a special room, a negative pressure room where all the air is vented through a filter and out to the outside. All the providers going into the room should be wearing an N95 mask or better. You know, N95 mask is a more expensive kind of mask that filters out 95% of the smaller particles. So that was the initial guidance, but very quickly they changed the guidance and said, well, no, actually, you don't need an N95 mask. You just need a regular surgical mask and eye protection, face protection, unless you're doing certain kinds of procedures. There's a lot of confusion about that, and the conflicting and changing guidance was not based on any clear science. You know, we were told that, well, the latest studies show you don't need this, but the studies, frankly, were all over the map, and there was plenty of evidence that we actually did need airborne protection. So most people didn't really believe it, and it caused all sorts of problems. You know, the local health departments and the hospitals followed the CDC on this. And really, the reason for it, we all know, is that there just weren't enough N95 masks to observe these precautions with the number of cases we're going to see. And the government was not willing to take the steps necessary to produce enough. You know, it would have required a massive New Deal, World War II type mobilization, and it would have been command and control kind of measures that obviously the Trump administration was not about to undertake. So instead, they lowered the standards and they put us all at risk. And, you know, we've seen the results. Many, many healthcare workers have become sick. A number have been hospitalized and a number have died from this illness.
Yeah, and then there's the 12-hour days, and some workers then working two shifts in a row, many of them working into the high teens during a shift. And also the isolation, right? That families can't visit, so it's the nurses who have to form the relationships, right, with people often who are dying, and the people are desperate, I suspect, the way you described them, especially in the public hospitals where you worked, I know, for many years, and know them well. It must be a kind of Dante's hell, but worse.
Yeah.
And real. You know, it's sort of unimaginable in some ways. And that's coming all over the United States, too, you know, in the hot spots as they develop.
Yeah. You know, I work all over the hospital. I go around and I see a lot. And there are some units where they are having multiple patients every day crashing, having to be intubated, and even dying. And, you know, as you said, the patients are isolated. Visitors are not allowed. And I obviously support this policy because, you know, we have to take fairly extreme measures to limit the spread. One of the worst things for me as a healthcare worker is to think that we might be the one of the leading sources of spreading this infection throughout the community because we're so much more exposed to it from all the patients coming in and, you know, so many more of us are going to be carrying it, whether we have symptoms or not. You know, I fully support the decision not to allow visitors, but it definitely takes a toll. And nurses do try to the extent that we can to provide that kind of contact and support, but it's very difficult. And we're also trying to limit our exposure. So it's very dangerous for a nurse to be in a patient's room for a long period at a time, even with protective equipment that they're going to be exposed to the virus and get sick is that much higher. And so the reality is that there's just no substitute for having family members at the bedside. you know, and nurses see this, and it's very painful to watch the suffering and the isolation of the patients. I wanted to say about the protective equipment. During the early days, we were told, no, you don't need N95 masks, and they actually locked them up. They were freely available, and once they realized that everyone was going to want to use them, they put them under lock and key, or they hid them, and you had to go and justify getting an N95 mask. You know, we've pushed back, and our union has pushed back. That has liberalized somewhat. For quite a few weeks now, in my hospital, we've had access to at least one N95 mask for the day. Many of the public hospitals only had one per week.
One per week?
One per week.
I guess and they try and sterilize it, though, after every shift, at least. But
no, there's no sterilization. They are collecting the used masks to supposedly eventually sterilize them. But as for now, we haven't been using reprocessed masks.
For a week, though, of breathing in and out of that stuff, it's almost inconceivable that anybody would put themselves through that.
It's totally inadequate. These are disposable masks. They're meant to be for one patient encounter, one patient care session. You walk out the room, you take the mask off, you throw it in the garbage. That's the way they were meant to be used. What we've been doing instead is we walk out of the room, we take the mask off, we put it in a paper bag with our name on it, and then when we go to see another patient, we take the mask out of the paper bag, put it on, go and see that patient. Now, you can imagine a paper bag, it's open. You're not necessarily putting the mask on in the same direction. So you could be transferring virus from one side of the mask to the other. It could be getting in, settling through the top of the paper bag. And we're putting face shields in the paper bag as well, which we've cleaned after one session. But there's very little training on how to do this. And there are many, many ways that these things could be cross-contaminated. That's the reason why, under normal circumstances, it's absolutely prohibited to reuse these items. They're not meant to be used that way. And, you know, you could be disciplined, potentially. The hospital could be cited by the Department of Health if staff are reusing these items. But during this pandemic, because of the shortage, we're being told, no, no, it's safe. You can reuse them. Put them in a paper bag, put them back on.
Nurses must recognize that they're, in fact, being asked to die for their patients because of the absolute incompetence and money-grubbing and systematic deficiencies of the medical care system. That's a powerful thing, I would think. We'll get to that in the second part of this interview. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, Variety Hour on Cable Radio. I'm talking to Ted Levine. A nurse in New York City who sees it all, who's worked in the public system, now he's in the private system, a quite privileged hospital, but that still suffers from all sorts of deficiencies. What is the extent to which nurses recognize that they're, in fact, being asked to risk their lives and their families' lives, right? When you go home, for your wife and kid, you worry that you're bringing something in that could be really dangerous for them. To what extent do nurses recognize the absolute immorality and crazed money-grubbing behavior of our capitalist elites and how that's responsible for what's happening?
I hear a lot from nurses that they feel as if they're being sacrificed, that they feel that they're being put at risk to save money. They're being put at risk because they believe that government and the hospitals will not do what's required or unwilling to do what's required. And I think there is a pretty widespread recognition among the nurses that I work with of that fact. Certainly, I see it as well. As with anything, there's a mix, and there are people who are just trying to focus on the positive, focusing on the heroism of healthcare workers who are risking ourselves for our patients. And certainly there is quite a bit of that. But at the same time, there are a lot of people who really see this as a failure of government at all levels and of the hospitals to do what's needed. And it's not because they can't, it's because they won't. And, you know, some are starting to identify that as a problem of capitalism itself, maybe not in those words, although you certainly hear that as well. You know, and starting to link it, people are starting to link it to broader issues that are all inextricably tied to what we're experiencing in the hospitals with this pandemic. The lack of health care for so many people, the fact that so many people are laid off and as a result have lost their health insurance and are delaying going to the hospital until they're really sick, or not going in because their problems, while serious, are not COVID. And because they're afraid of what's going to happen, or because they just can't afford it. So there's a growing awareness among nurses that what we experience in our jobs day to day is linked directly to so many larger things that are happening, so many larger things that are not happening. You know, and many of us are trying to make that case very actively. It's not just that we need N95 masks and we need more staff. You know, we also need government at all levels to be doing what's required to really slow the growth of this pandemic and control it, and to allow for our economies to open safely again, for people to go back to work safely. The contact tracing, the wide-scale testing, the quarantine, and, you know, the provision of services to people under quarantine. All these things, they call for a very different model of government and the economy. Certainly something is at least as robust as the New Deal. And they kind of push at the limits of capitalism in some ways. So I think there are potentials for people to see that, and there's a growing awareness. I won't say that there's a massive upsurge. There are small but growing numbers of healthcare workers who are speaking out about these things. But we're not yet at the point where the numbers are big enough and the actions are disruptive enough to force a change. We've seen some small changes, but the kind of big changes that we really need, we're not there yet.
That was Old Mole Bill Resnick talking with New York City nurse Ted Levine about the hellish conditions that New York nurses are facing and the growing recognition that they are risking their lives and the lives of their families because of the malfeasance, incompetence, and profit-at-any-cost operations of our capitalist elites. Much more on the political possibilities that are raised in part two of the interview next week on the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO Radio. And now, our book mole, also known as Larry Bolden, reviews Wildlife by Molly Gloss.
Good morning, readers. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and I am standing in again this morning for our book mole, Larry Bolden, who has reviewed for us today a novel by Northwest writer Molly Gloss entitled Wildlife. Quote, I admit I was pierced with loneliness. There is something about a lighted room when you are standing outside it in the cold night. End quote. Although I was already aware of what a fine writer Molly Gloss is from having read her novel, Jump Off Creek, I must admit I was stunned by the depth of her wisdom in her 2000 novel, Wildlife. Writing as Charlotte Bridger Drummond, or simply CBD, Gloss creates a character who is tough, independent, and a fully fledged feminist. Set in the early 1900s in a small logging town on the borders of Oregon and Washington, Charlotte is a widowed mother of five boys who supports her family by writing women's adventure novels. Charlotte is fiercely independent. She wears men's clothes, smokes cigars or a pipe in public, eschews domestic tasks as far as possible, and creates for herself a private writing space, a room of her own. Charlotte is irreverent and often very humorous in her descriptions of men and of their laughably absurd views of the weakness of women. The men in the logging camps are fond of telling tall tales about wild men of the woods, and while Charlotte herself is not opposed to Wild West tales, she is scornful of the way men tell their stories as attempts to scare women and children. The novel is as much about writing as it is about the adventure Charlotte goes through when she joins a search party looking for a young girl, Harriet, who has been lost in the woods and who loggers claimed was carried off by a huge, hairy, ape-like animal. As the story begins to unfold, it transpires that Charlotte herself becomes separated from the rest of the search party. Quoting Samuel Butler as she begins to describe her life lost in the wild, Molly Gloss begins to prepare her readers to suspend disbelief and allow her to spin her story. Quote, "When anything in my books is strange and outré, it is probably drawn straight from nature as close as I could draw it. When it is plausible, there is probably no particular and especial foundation for it." End quote. Even the domestic help Charlotte has hired to free her up from many domestic tasks is outwardly disdainful of Charlotte's lack of femininity and scolds her for spending so much time away from her children and locked in her writing shed. Quote, "She was half inclined to cry at being unable to devote herself entirely to her work, though she considered the work only a means to an end, which was the support of her family. In later years, she would discover that the work was everything to her, everything, but now she tossed and tossed, trying to explain and defend something that shifted and was elusive. And at such times, she has secretly, horrifyingly, wished for a calamity that would free her of the weight, the otherwise inescapable burden of her maternity." End quote. Or as Charlotte herself says, quote, "If I had been born a man, I would have created for myself a world full of work and egoism and imagined that my whole life belonged to me. But since I was born a woman, I suffered the usual girlish desires and aspirations, and I believe that my life should eventually be joined to a husband." End quote. Both a mother and a wife by the age of 20, and then within 10 years, Charlotte is a widowed wife and mother of 5 boys. All of this novel is peppered with stories and quotes from women about what they are expected to write about. I have said nothing yet about Charlotte's life while lost in the wild, and I don't intend to reveal much of that story to you. Suffice it to say that Charlotte, starving and near dead, is taken in by a family of human-like creatures who allow her to hunt and gather with them and who cause her to question her previous beliefs about the relations between humans and creatures of the woods. If you are a reader wholly opposed to fantastical literature, then this may not be the book for you. But I would also remind you of the splendid books of Ursula K. Le Guin and invite you to suspend for a time your skepticism. Gloss may well be describing herself, or Le Guin, or countless other women writers as she speaks in the voice of CBD. Quote, "As a thoroughgoing feminist and a woman who has herself thrown over the traces of domestication as much as can be done without risking arrest, I do my best to swim against the tide. For heroine of a scientific romance, I will always choose the scientifically inclined daughter or sister of a world-renowned anthropologist. And for the Western romance, look for a girl who can ride and shoot, a ranch girl, born and raised in the West." End quote. Although I myself have in the past rejected most fantasy writing, in the past couple of decades I have been more open to fantasy fiction as a vehicle for environmental issues, for women's fiction, and simply for the delight of the stories. This is a book I could well have reviewed simply by stringing together quotes from the novel. It is a wonderfully humorous novel as it pokes fun at men and holds up to the light expectations of women, not only of the West or of days gone by, but of us here now. I have been talking to you today about Molly Gloss' novel, Wildlife. This is Patricia Kullberg, reading for Larry Bolden and for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry Bolden, for that book review. and Patricia Kohlberg for reading it for us. And now, time for the well-read read. Today's well-read read draws on two works, and what's fascinating about them is that they use the same historical material, the same novels, and the novels about plagues, in fact, and come to very, very different conclusions. The question is why? How could they use the same literature and interpret them so differently? I'm going to start with a piece by Orhan Pamuk, a Turkish writer. Pamuk has been imprisoned, he's been exiled, he also has won the Nobel Prize. This is a piece that the New York Times printed in translation called What the Great Pandemic Novels Teach Us by Orhan Pamuk. For the past 4 years, I have been writing a historical novel set in 1901 during what is known as the Third Plague Pandemic, an outbreak of bubonic plague that killed millions of people in Asia, but not very many in Europe. Over the past 2 months, friends and family, editors and journalists who know the subject of that novel, Nights of Plague, have been asking me a barrage of questions about pandemics. They are most curious about similarities between the current coronavirus pandemic and the historical outbreaks of plague and cholera. There is an overabundance of similarities. Throughout human and literary history, what makes pandemics alike is not mere commonality of germs and viruses, but that our initial responses were always the same. The initial response to the outbreak of a pandemic has always been denial. National and local governments have always been late to respond and have distorted facts and manipulated figures to deny the existence of the outbreak. In the early pages of A Journal of the Plague Year, the single most illuminating work of literature ever written on contagion and human behavior, Daniel Defoe reports that in 1664, local authorities in some neighborhoods of London tried to make the number of plague deaths appear lower than it was by registering other invented diseases as the recorded cause of death. Humanity's other universal and seemingly unprompted response to pandemics has always been to create rumors and spread false information. The most common rumors during outbreaks of plague were about who had brought the disease in and where it had come from. Around mid-March, as panic and fear began to spread through Turkey, the manager of my bank in my neighborhood in Istanbul told me with a knowing air that this thing was China's economic retort to the United States and the rest of the world. Like evil itself, plague was always portrayed as something that had come from outside. It had struck elsewhere before, and not enough had been done to contain it. In his account of the spread of plague in Athens, Thucydides began by noting that the outbreak had started far away in Ethiopia and Egypt. Disease is foreign. It comes from outside. It is brought in with malicious intent. Rumors about the supposed identity of its original carriers are always the most pervasive and popular. The history and literature of plagues shows us that the intensity of the suffering, of the fear of death, of the metaphysical dread, and of the sense of the uncanny experienced by the stricken populace will also determine the depth of their anger and political discontent. The terror we are feeling however, excludes imagination and individuality, and it reveals how unexpectedly similar our fragile lives and shared humanity really are. Fear, like the thought of dying, makes us feel alone, but the recognition that we are all experiencing a similar anguish draws us out of our loneliness. The knowledge that the whole of humanity, from Thailand to New York, shares our anxieties about how and where to use a face mask, the safest way to deal with the food we have bought from the grocer, and whether to quarantine and self-quarantine, is a constant reminder that we are not alone. It begets a sense of solidarity. We are no longer mortified by our fear. We discover a humility in it that encourages mutual understanding. Eventually, I realized that fear elicits two distinct responses in me, and perhaps in all of us. Sometimes it causes me to withdraw into myself, towards solitude and silence, but other times it teaches me to be humble and to practice solidarity. These have been extracts from the Orhan Pamuk piece. He then goes on to talk about the cultural and historical factors that lead to stereotypes about Muslim and Asian fatalism and what he calls the preconceived notion that plagues and other epidemics always come from the darkest recesses of the East. He concludes his essay, "For a better world to emerge after this pandemic, we must embrace and nourish the feelings of humility and solidarity engendered by the current moment." Now, David Brooks, a columnist for the New York Times, has read the same literature that Pamuk has. He too has read Defoe, The Journal of the Plague Year, and he's read Dostoevsky, and he's read Camus, The Plague, and he's read the Decameron, some of the same sources that Pamuk relies on. I didn't read everything that Pamuk wrote, but for David Brooks, they lead to quite different lessons. As you can tell from the title of his New York Times piece, "Pandemics Kill Compassion." So here are just a couple of paragraphs. I don't want to read his entire essay, but I do want to then reflect on why he draws different lessons from the same kind of background literature. Here are two of his paragraphs. "This explains one of the puzzling features of the 1918 pandemic." He's talking about the so-called Spanish flu, which, as many of our listeners know, originated not in Spain, but in Kansas. Back to David Brooks. "When it was over, people didn't talk about it. There were very few books or plays written about it. Roughly 675,000 Americans lost their lives to the flu, compared with 53,000 in battle in World War I. And yet it left almost no conscious cultural mark. Perhaps it's because people didn't like who they had become. It was a shameful memory, and therefore suppressed." In her 1976 dissertation, A Cruel Wind, Dorothy Ann Pettit argues that the 1918 flu pandemic contributed to a kind of spiritual torpor afterward. People emerged from it physically and spiritually fatigued. "The flu," Pettit writes, "had a sobering and disillusioning effect on the national spirit." Without much hope, Brooks concludes, "It wouldn't be a bad idea to take steps to fight the moral disease that accompanies the physical one." So much for David Brooks. So what do we take away from him? First, coming out of 1918, there's spiritual torpor, spiritual fatigue, a sobering effect on the national spirit, moral disease. Well, that doesn't correspond to the 1919 that I know. To begin with, we've got the Seattle General Strike, the glorious days when workers in Seattle took over and ran the city to perfection, much better than it had been run before or since. We've got a vast year of strikes, of labor activism, one of the greatest in American history. The Boston police even go on strike, a justifiable strike, because their wages hadn't been raised since, as I remember, since around the Civil War. Hundreds of thousands of steelworkers are on strike. It's a year of major activism. And one of the responses, of course, is the Palmer raids and the vast repressive apparatus of the government mobilized. None of this is torpor or fatigue. So how do we account for, again, Brooks coming out with such different conclusions from what we got with Orhan Pamuk? My quick response would be gloom in, gloom out. If your premise is that people are not capable of much compassion or solidarity or communality, that we humans are mainly individuals looking out for ourselves, and that's all that can be expected of us, and that I think does characterize the premises that Brooks promotes regularly in his columns, then the lessons you draw are about the moral disease accompanying the physical. If, on the other hand, you see the possibility of a better world emerging along with Orhan Pamuk, this now also represents an opportunity. Let's take advantage of it. This has been Norm Diamond with The Well-Read Red. And that's it for today's program. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM, Portland. I want to thank, as we leave, I want to thank Larry Bolden for his review, Patricia Kohlberg for acting as our voice all the way through today's program, and Bill Resnick for his interview with Ted Levine. Part two of that will be next week. This is Norm Diamond reminding you, tune in next week to the Old Mole Variety Hour. And please remember, during these tough times, KBOO needs your support. Go to the website kboo.fm if you're able and donate.